welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight, we're going to have an interesting show about the development of self. You might say, well, where does the self come from? It's just like asking, where does God come from? So we're going to have an interesting show from that standpoint. And again, this is a show about metaphysics and physics, spirituality, cosmology, ontology, and a lot of other ologies, you know, that's a study of. And then, in addition, generally, I would say how science fits in with spiritual principles. So that's a way to kind of put it all together, if you haven't heard the show before. And the other thing I want to mention tonight is that we've got new equipment that really is working great. Last week, we were experimenting. This week, I think we've got it nailed down pretty good. And from what I just heard from Seth, our engineer, we sound great. So that's good. And again, nothing major was done. It was just one piece of equipment was kind of on its way out. And when something goes bad, it goes bad in radio real good. It's so good and bad at the same time. So anyway, tonight, I thought it would be interesting to talk about the development of self, not just in human beings. I'm going to go right from where, you know, the very earliest development of a self is. And hopefully this will make some sense to our listeners, because one of the areas that people have a lot of concern about, they don't know that that's what they're concerned about, though, is the concept of self. Now, why is that? Well, to begin with, which is the rationale for tonight's show, the self is really the part of us that gives us a kind of understanding, we'll say, of who we are in relationship to everything else, and how and what ways we fit in with the universe. And for human beings in particular, it gives us the operational ability to determine that there is or is not a creator or God. Eventually it does. And it also gives us the fear of death, and the concern we have about life and its meaning versus death and our fears about it. So all that is coming from one thing, the self. If you don't have a self, almost everything I just said goes out the window. And there's lots of things that are alive, everything from fish, most fish, to plants and lower-level animals that have absolutely no self. So those things I just said don't affect those creatures like they do human beings. So this is a very interesting subject. That doesn't mean, by the way, there is no self part of the lower forms of life, because we're going to start with that issue. And let me define for you what a self is, okay, just so you understand it. A self is a part of spirit, okay? It's composed of spirit that has decided to focus itself on a particular group of life forms or a particular individual life form. So there are two different kinds of self. There's a group self, or a group of life forms, which could be, oh, let's say, a specific genus of fly, okay? All the flies of that genus are kind of together, you know, and they have a very interesting commonality. And part of that is that they have a sort of self, but it is an individual. Their self does only a few things for it. It gives them various low-level instincts. And those instincts are to, in certain fairly complex ways, guide their behavior so that their species can survive. And this would be a narrow species of fly, most likely, because there's a whole bunch of different group selves for different kinds of flies. But it gives them some ability to know how to mate, where to be, and what to do for to stay alive at certain times in certain environments. I mean, it just makes sense. And most people say, well, instincts are something inside the fly. Actually, they're not. Instincts are coming from the group self that is connected to the group soul of that particular species of fly. Isn't that interesting? Okay, so you can think about that. Now, again, I'm giving us general, we'll say, definitions. I like to start our show with definitions so that we all know what I'm talking about. Sometimes I don't know what I'm talking about, but when I don't, you can figure that out for yourself. But at any rate, the fly and everything else that is at that level is composed, is informed by a self, and the self is composed of spirit that has come together. Now, spirit is a part of God's thought. That's what spirit is, part of God's thought. Comes together and says, any other spirit around here that would like to join with me and inform this species of fly, come on and get it. They all get together. I mean, all this thought gets together and forms a field of thought that is confined to dealing with a specific species of fly. And it's not that hard for spirit to do that because the spirit really does enjoin itself in a field with other thought that is similar to itself. So, and that's a natural state because if you think about it, thought does have a common denominator of wanting to be around and part of thought that fits in with itself. Even in our own minds, when you think about something, you'll notice that your thoughts tend to move, particularly if you're a relatively mentally healthy person, towards similar subjects in any particular instance of time. And that's really cool for spirit. Spirit likes to stick around spirit that has similar capabilities and similar interests in thought. Make sense? Okay. And that's why human beings who are so guided by how they think do exactly the same thing with other human beings. Interesting thing. But we'll get to that later in the show. All right, so spirit, though, is composed of a piece of God's thought to begin with. Some of this is way away from God in comparison to the ability God has, but still has a lot of light within it and is not dark, so to speak. So selves always have some degree of light within themselves, and the reason for this is that they're composed of thought that is somewhere in the monastic realm, the mental dimension of time and space, which has spirit in it that is always, to some degree, has some light. I mean, in other words, there's some amount of God's thought left in that spirit. It isn't called darkened spirit, because spirit, once it gets below the mental plane, particularly below the middle of the mental plane, it starts picking up darker and darker thought. And then it may not have enough light, not really enough light, to join with other spirit in ways that would in some way resemble God's thought. That kind of spirit can definitely inform a life form, but it can't create a self any longer. So cells are always composed of spirit that have some level of light in them and have some resemblance, although it may not be very close, but some resemblance to the thought of its creator, of God. And if you want to go further into this, you can look into Lysine Hidden Meaning or some of the other things I've written, or some of the other shows, to find out where spirit came from, and you'll find out it came from a thing called a monad, which split itself into spirit and intelligent activity, and intelligent activity became energy. So then you have spirit and energy. And they interplay together. But that's a different part of a different show. So for right now, we're just trying to figure out where the self comes from. It comes from spirit. And spirit that's somewhat enlightened, is found in the mental world or above, and is always representing some part of God's mind to some extent. Not 100%, maybe not even 50%, but at least enough so that there's some light within it. Okay. So let's start at the earliest parts of self-creation. A group soul, I mentioned that earlier, a group soul is a being, okay? It's a being. It's different than self because it's a being. What's the difference? A being is a self combined with sense. The two together become a being. So a self alone is not a being, because it doesn't have sense. And a sense alone isn't a being because it doesn't have self. You take the self, you add it together with the sense, and now you can have being. Or I should say senses in some circumstances, of course, but I'm using the lowest common denominator, which would be a sense. Okay, a whole sense with some degree of self produces a being, and the beings that it produces in the mental world, those beings are called souls. Well, and there's about equal measure between the amount of sense in a soul and the amount of self that is in the soul. So if we were to say, okay, define a soul is a being that has some significant amount, but not a huge amount, of God's thought within it. In other words, it's not the largest amount of God's thought. It's not God. But it's a subcategory, and it has a significant amount of God's thought, and it has a significant amount of sense, so the sense is whole and undamaged, so it gets pretty clear information from the sense or senses that it uses, and the amount of sense it has, in other words, the amount of information it takes into itself is virtually equal to the amount of self that it has that is able to interpret and understand the information that comes from the sense. So as it's sensing, it is understanding the information in the sense and able to do so in real time pretty close to equal amounts and without a lot of what we call mistakes. So it does so with pretty good accuracy. That's a soul. You thought it was really complicated to figure out what a soul is. See? It's not so hard. All right, so a soul is that. And for those people who say, well, I want to know a lot more about souls, well, there's a chapter 6 in a book I wrote, a textbook, Life's in Meaning. You can go to that book, and you can read chapter 6, and you'll say, oh, that's what a soul is. But not surprising, the two chapters before chapter 6, chapter 4 is about energy and spirit, and chapter 5 is about cells. And then it goes to chapter 6, which is about souls. You see how you can't really get to the soul if you don't know what spirit and energy are, and then if you don't understand how itself is composed of it, composed of the spirit part, and then the energy part comes in and joins, and you get the sense, and then you end up with soul. So that's why those chapters are in that order, because it's just how the universe was created. Okay, so the book followed the method of creation of our universe. Okay, now, the very beginning of the development of cells starts strangely with things that aren't even alive. You say, well, what good is a cell for something that's not alive? Well, I call it pre-life. You probably call it minerals and chemistry and a lot of the stuff that's just stuff, things out there that are material form. In some cases, they exist also in very small ways, maybe in the astral world and in a mental concept way. But they mostly exist here in the etheric physical world. The electromagnetic part and mostly the physical part of the physical world is where these things exist. We call them rocks. We call them elements. We call them stuff that's all around us. But we wouldn't say they're alive because they're not sentient. Now, what is sentience? Well, something is sentient when it is capable of having some level of understanding of self, yes, coming from some of its own input to a self within a soul. So, in other words, it itself doesn't have to know it has a self, whatever that little thing is, maybe a blade of grass. The blade of grass doesn't have to know it has a self. But the soul, the group soul of that particular kind of grass, has to know it has a self and has to understand why and what it is doing in terms of informing all the little blades of grass that are relevant to it, the genes or the specifics of that genetic structure of that kind of grass. So that's a good thing, because you want to have that kind of relationship. Now, again, the grass doesn't have itself, but not on any individual level, but it has something on a group level. But the mineral doesn't. The mineral, this is the strangest thing about cells, is that the group soul, okay, of minerals has an emerging self. It does have a self, but that self can do almost nothing to feedback in terms of what we call instincts to most minerals. All it can do is on a chemistry level, and to humans this doesn't make any sense at all. To someone that's maybe advanced beyond human, it makes more sense. But I tried to explain it to you, and you see if you can understand or think, you know, you can at least make the leap to see if it makes some sense to you. Yeah, when we talk about chemistry, we talk about how on a subatomic level, due to quantum physics, if you understand the relationship of the orbits and things and why things are attracted or not attracted, or if you just know classical chemistry. The basis of the attraction of various types of elements is more than just a mathematical number, and it's more than just what you think of in terms of the periodic table. It's really based upon how eventually those elements will go together to be able to create various forms of life. You have to look ahead of where the elements eventually have an interplay in developing more complex chemical structures that we call organic structures rather than inorganic. And then it starts revealing itself to someone who studies DNA or RNA. You start seeing that, you know, even the chemistry needs itself because it's all pointed towards developing life. And that, of course, leads us to a creator and to realizing that the universe is not some kind of random event sort of thing. And there's a self needed, therefore, even for the most basic of elements working together just to create, you know, a bit more complex but non-organic kinds of compounds and substances that most people would still think aren't actually alive. Now, the point here is that the self is kind of thinking ahead so that the proper forms of chemistry, like on a planet, are going to be developed in ways and appropriate times for there to be part of a plan to create life on that planet. You have to see it in a big picture way to see that chemistry is behind it all and that there is a self. Now, the self is nothing like we would think of, like, well, it's instincts. No, it's more based upon laws in physics and the way some of those laws are really not laws. You see, most of the chemistry laws of the 19th century, and even the 18th century, but going in mostly into the 19th century, are not the truth. They're based upon superficial observations of the periodic table and the way things seem to react in the laboratory. What's unseen is the quantum physical effects, which really has to do more with how, in strange ways, even electrons are making choices all the time that we can't understand. And all these combined choices have something going on behind their scenes that makes the whole world react in a way that is rational rather than is very, very confusing and destructive. And if there wasn't something behind the whole system, it wouldn't work. I can tell you that. It just wouldn't work. Because it's either one or two. It's either there's thought involved or there's randomness. There's nothing like in between that. And so, interestingly, there has to be even a self for a group soul for something as basic as the elements and some of those more complex, eventually organic compounds that are created by these more sophisticated forms of chemistry. And it's just amazing. Even down to the level of a single, you know, DNA stream, has an amazing array of self-involvement that we really don't see very easily. Okay, so that's the most basic self, is a self that deals with something that I would call pre-life. And there are various levels of that, and you can get down to the most subtle kinds. And beyond that, once you end up with life, no matter how basic the life is something that is sentient, can recreate itself, and it has to have both of those qualities. Just because something can recreate itself, if it isn't sentient, it isn't alive. And something that cannot recreate itself, but is sentient, is not alive either, which is a whole other theory and understanding to get to that point. It's got to have both. You have to have something that's creative and sentient, both. And creative begins usually with itself and ends with other things besides. So the very first form of creation in most life is procreation. There are some exceptions, but even then, when you get down to it, it turns out that one form of life is changing into another, and so it is a form of kind of procreation. So procreation, creation, sentiency has to come together to make something alive, okay? And there's a formula for determining sentiency in metaphysics, which is most interesting, and that is that something that is alive has to have movement in two different ways. It has to be able to have some form of movement. Now, this may not be locomotion as we understand, but it could be internal growth. But it has to have some form of movement in the dimension it exists in. But in the very next dimension next to it, it also has to have a movement of consciousness so that part of it exists in the second or higher dimension. Most people don't know that. And that's a hidden thing in metaphysics, except in places where it's been demystified. So you got to have both, because there has to be this kind of space, we'll say, for intelligent activity to take place in. If intelligent activity cannot be eventually realized, then the third part of God's mind can't exist, and there can't be anything that we call life. You have to have all three parts of God in every living thing, or we wouldn't call it alive. It could be pre-life if something's missing, but it can't be actually alive. That means it isn't going to be creative and sentient together. Most interesting. All right. Now, I know I'm going pretty fast here, because I figure that you can listen to this show over again. And I'm just trying to get to the basics of things so that we don't get lost when we get later on into more complex issues about higher life forms and humans, which is, I guess, what we're aiming for, is to really understand how the self becomes more and more important in these higher life forms, and especially in us, and why we have so many conflicts involving this one part of us. And that's all going to be later in the show. So if you have a lot of issues in your life, tonight's show could be a self-help show, right? I mean, it's an interesting play on words, but it could be, because most people, when they have difficulties in their life, they're almost always caused by themselves and caused by their self not being in the correct relationship with their personality and with their senses and bodies, and things are therefore going amok because of that. All right, so let's continue on with the group soul idea. So eventually we do get living things that have group souls. And where's the group soul? I mean, I said the mental plane. Let's be more specific. The group soul is usually found somewhere in what is called the third tier, or we'll just call it the third subplane of the mental plane. Usually, there's a higher and a lower part of that subplane, that it's divided finally into sub-subplanes. And usually in the higher part, where more spiritual thought is, because the soul is a little bit more advanced than itself is. And it's usually found somewhere in there. That's where all the group souls are found. They're all found there. They tend to think mostly about only the species that they inform. Or if it's a non-living group soul, the mineral or the elements of the mineral, whatever they're informing. That's what they tend, you know, focus their attention on. So it's very individual. Not much in the way of working well with a lot of other group souls different from themselves. And they tend to isolate their thinking and their, we'll say, input into that small segment of life. But the self is kind of strange because the self is so undeveloped in a group soul for the most part that it doesn't exist in any one sub-subplane as it does in higher level living creatures. But in the group soul, for most of the lower forms of life and the pre-life, it is kind of blurred pretty badly in the three lowest parts of the higher mental plane, usually with an emphasis on one of the three, consistently out of balance with the other two. So it's like it's blurred over three sub-subplanes from what's called the fifth, sixth, and seventh sub-subplanes. On this one little energy place, some people call it a piece of the lotus, that unfortunately is very imbalanced. If it's minerals, as an example, the seventh sub-subplane part of it is the self, where the self is so focused there that it doesn't get in a balanced way thought that makes any sense beyond just its pressure and heat and other things that are around it. It gets very minimal amounts of understanding about anything else of its environment. In some other cases, if it's a low level of life, it may only understand whether or not it has enough water and or enough air or enough or whatever to even exist in, or if it has the ability to find some energy source as food. That may be found in the sixth subplane. So, I mean, you have all these strange, very, very confined selves that deal with such small fractions of the question of staying alive. And there's a little bit of all of the three parts, but they're not well represented in a balanced way. So you find a lot of the things that are pre-life or that are low levels of life don't have a high degree of, we'll say, creativity, or don't have, in some other cases, a high degree of adaptivity. As a matter of fact, they kind of exchange one for the other. So in these low forms of life or pre-life, if they're not even alive yet, but what happens is they give up adaptability for creativity, or they give up creativity for adaptability. But they usually don't have a balance of the two, which is a strange thing, because if you have too much creativity and not enough adaptability, your lifespan is short, okay? And if you have too much adaptability for virtually no creativity, you may live a long time, but not do much in it. Yeah, you just sort of sit around like an algae. You grow more and you split, you grow more and split, more and split. And, you know, but you don't do much else. So there isn't a lot of interesting creativity to that kind of life. But it could live a long time. Because the more adaptable something is, the longer it lives, the more creative it is, the more meaningful life is that it has. The two have to be in balance to get some of both. Okay. And the self is very much involved in it, by the way. The self is very concerned about staying alive and about gaining some kind of meaning in its own existence. And like I said, it needs those two balanced for the self to be able to feel good about it. If there is such a thing. I realize that sounds, you know, like we're putting a lot of human things in there. But in order for it to have some, call it good feeling, about its life, it needs to have an interesting balance between these. And it could be a very low level. As long as they're balanced, that self might be feeling good about its life. All right. So, now, when we look at the next step up, you know, if you're going to go to a little higher life form, let's say you're going to plants, well, the plants tend to be a form of life that attain a much better balance than the very lowest forms, like amoeba or whatever. And they have in general, not all plants. So I'm not talking about, you know, again, algae is technically a plant, kind of. It really isn't, by the way, but it's moving in that direction. And so when you look at this, you see a plant as an organism, and not as one cell, piece of an algae in a colony, but an organism. Then at that point, the self, because there is organization, because you have specialization within each part of the life form, even though it's a group soul, there is a lot more of the both adaptability and the creativity. And so, as an example, plants are maybe creating all kinds of interesting things, like food and oxygen and you name it, all kinds of things can be going on. That doesn't mean that algae can't use a little bit of that, too, but they're doing it more single-minded. It's one single thing. Plants do a lot of variety of things. They take minerals out of the soil, they change the chemistry of that, and they can make sugars, they can eventually make all kinds of things. And so the results are that you get a really different kind of self out of that. The self now has grown to the point where its adaptability is in a lot of different ways. It can adapt to many different things in its environment. And its creativity is vast. It can be creating air, it can be creating food, it can be filtering water, it can be giving off transpiration for humidity and cooling off the environment, it could be providing shade. I mean, you can go into all these things, and before long, you can see that this self is now starting to really sound like what we could imagine would be a real operational self by our standards. Not to sell the lowest selves short. I mean, they're doing something, but nothing like what we're talking about in a more organized life form. And then as we move further, and further, so we go into lower-level animals. I mean, I'm going to skip over the microbes and things like that because they're very, very low. Those are very, very low forms of life. And those have their own categories, just like I said, algae. And before algae, there are certain kinds of bacteria that really just very low forms of self. And they do very little, but maybe they may make excellent producers of oxygen. And maybe that's all they're supposed to do is produce a lot of oxygen. Okay, well, that's a good thing. If you need a lot of oxygen in a world from a couple billion years ago, maybe a great idea. Maybe do nothing today. But a few billion years ago, good thing. Okay. So, but they still may exist, by the way. Because, again, they didn't do much creativity, so they had a long life. They existed for 3 billion years, so, and some of them can still be found, so, you know, just in case things go really bad, they could start up life maybe again. It might take a long time. All right. So, when we get to the higher forms of life and continue on to animals and that are more complex, really interesting stuff starts happening because this self-structure, instead of being, it's still blurred a little bit in time and space because it's found in three different places, so to speak, but it has grown enormously. Now it's dealing with all kinds of things like mobility and the ability to make choices about where and how the life form will place itself in its own environment and change that placement somewhat at will. That's a big difference between that and plants. You know, plants pretty much are missing that, you know. And animals are, they have this ability to usually move around. And that's a big deal because their choices about movement gives them the ability, by changing their environment, to give tremendously more creation in their life. And they have to fight, unfortunately, more to adapt to all the different changes they're making. So some of their adaptability has to go way up, or they die, because if they're, you know, if they're going along and if they walk off a cliff or whatever, they're going to have to survive that kind of debacle that they create for themselves. So this is a totally new thing. The self, for these creatures, has now developed to a point where its overall adaptability has to have gone way up, creativity has gone way up, procreation is usually much more complex. We see more often, although plants have it to begin with, sexual forms of procreation. Plants have, some plants, particularly flowering plants, have sexual procreation. But animals, way more so, because in plants, there's the mobility is lacking, right? It doesn't, it's off to the wind, or some insect comes and carries it, and, or things just fall in from one place of a plant to another. It doesn't have the ability to go out and find uniquely new genetic combinations to procreate with the way animals can. And so now creation goes way up just by the very fact that the sexuality is becoming more complex. Now, not all animals are sexual, but most are. There's still some asexual animals, you know about that. But again, we're dealing mostly with animals of very low complexity, usually that are virtually microbial in form. So, or if not, then they, you know, are no more than a, you know, hematobe. They're just, you know, much more than worms and that kind of thing. Because anything more complex than that can't just split itself up and divide in two. Yet then it has to usually involve others of its kind to mate with. And the self is part of this whole process. You need a more complex self if you're going to have complex sexual means of getting together. You can see that. And this is, I love this example that I'm giving you, because I think for a lot of people this is a foundation for starting to see the emergence of how we're going to get closer to the human self. But there's a lot bigger picture here, and I'm not going to quite get to it in this beginning part of the show. But still, it's really neat to see that the self really comes along as you move up the various parts of the kingdoms. And that in the beginning, you can barely notice it. And then here we are just in the middle of animals, say, and it's very noticeable that the group soul self is very involved. Now, it's complex behaviors, but there's still instincts. The self is not providing individual thought to the animal, that the animal says, gee, I know who I am and I know where I'm going. Now, the animal pretty much doesn't know who it is. It doesn't have much understanding of itself. It just is providing information through its senses collectively with a lot of other animals, and the self averages the thought into something called preconceptual thought and says, yeah, that's how you all are going to do it based upon the best that I can come up with now, and I'll change it if a lot of you give me different information. But just one or two, if you give me something different, I ignore that, because it doesn't mean anything to me, because my time, the time I'm focused on, is too large to cover the events of this one creature. I have to take the last year or two and how those events, or maybe the last decade, have all the creatures telling me things of the kind that I'm informing before I really understand what to tell them. You see how different that is of a self than what a human being is. The time gets all, it's all blurred for a long period of time, it could be months, years, before the self comes to a conclusion that's going to be different. Very hard to change instincts. Instincts stay around for a long time because you've got to have a lot of the species giving different information so that the self says, it's been a couple of years and keep getting different information, time to change the instincts a little bit. Now, that's way different than the theory of evolution. Because evolution says it's all like trial and error. That's not true. And the proof of it is time. The self saves about 10 times the amount of time that it takes to change species. It's way faster than evolution would be. And if you track the two, you'll see that evolution doesn't work, whereas this system of self with evolution does. The two are working together, but one alone does not work. Okay, listen, we'll come back to the rest of tonight's show. Eventually, we're going to be dealing with human self. For those of you who say, well, this is kind of interesting, but when are we going to get to myself? Well, we'll be getting there. Just hold on. And we'll be back in about 2 minutes and 30 seconds from right now.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. McFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight we're talking about the development of self. And if you missed the first part of the show, well, you can keep listening and you'll hear a lot of examples, but you may not understand everything about those examples because you might say, well, what about where did it come from? And then you can listen to the show later on, the first part that you missed. Hopefully you didn't miss the first part. So we can continue on with most of our people right from where we're at. Okay, so you can see that the self really is an important part of life. And it isn't easy for a group soul to develop a self because it can't think in the time frame that the individual life forms that it informs are having experiences. It just can't do that. Why, you might ask, is because the soul itself is formulated in a part of the mental world where its time, the time it exists in, is not great enough for its thought processes to be able to understand so much about the world that its life forms are in on any individual scale. It can only say it's overwhelming to it. I can just understand the averages of what all these life forms are doing. That's the best it can do. It just hasn't developed the creative aspect of its existence. It hasn't developed the intelligence yet. And so it's a sort of soul in training, you might say. But all souls are kind of in training, but in, even more so than, say, an individual human soul, for sure. And it's thinking in a part of the mental world that is conceptual, but it's the lowest part, where concepts are not full enough, they aren't big enough, to include time to the point where it can think fast enough to understand what an individual life form is doing. So it informs a bunch of, maybe a million, you know, or a billion, who knows, life forms of a specific species, but it does so using averages, rather than what you call preconceptual thought, so that it can just get by. Now, for the individual life forms, there's very little that they can do, because they're not getting informed by any self. So their ability to create and adapt is very limited, depending upon the overall level that the soul is developed at. The most advanced souls are that of the primates, the highest animals, you know, and the primates and the whales, dogs and dolphins, and that those kinds of creatures have, we'll say, a group soul that is in many respects about as high as it gets for wild animals. And some of those animals, such as dogs, if they're not wild dogs, are domesticated. And if they have contact with humans, then they have a little help. They get a little help from their friends. So the group soul still exists for those animals to some extent, but they also rely on the self of the humans around them, if they're a pet, or if even if they're an animal kept for working purposes, they have a contact with humans, then they get a little bit of self for the human as well. Sort of borrowed, you might say, because we're thinking for them, and we're helping them to think better. And sometimes we're helping them to think outside of the preconceptual thought of their instincts. How many people do you know that have had all kinds of animals, both on a farm or working setting, and in a pet kind of setting, the farm and working animals, even those, get some help with their instincts, although not as much by far than the animals who are pets, which are oftentimes deliberately treated in ways to get them out of their instinctual behaviors and into a more, we'll say, conceptual rather than preconceptual way of thinking about things, and more immediate, so they can react and respond to us more as our equals than as some lower-level life form, right? Isn't that what we do? We like that. That makes us feel better because our self wants to bring their self higher. And so we have this urge to do that. Why? Because, remember what I said at the beginning of the show, that spirit wants to be with spirit of its same kind or similar kind. And if we want our animals to be thinking a little bit like us or a lot like us, depending upon their overall level of development. I mean, if you've got a mouse as a pet, it's going to only have some level of self-developed, relatively much lower than ours. And we wouldn't expect that to respond to the way a dog or a cat might, that we might have as a pet. But we still might give it a try. We might give it some, we want to see some improvement in its spirit, which is itself. And that's just the nature of our spirit. That's what we want. And so this is the nature of spirit in general. And interestingly, even animals can have pets of a lower form that they may want to develop itself in. It's very interesting. So it isn't just humans that have that, although we certainly have a lot more of it than anything lower than us in development. Yeah. Okay. So now let's go up to these higher animals. What's going on with them? Well, the good news is that the group souls of these animals are really advanced. And you could say, well, where are those group souls headed to? Okay, there has to be some end to the system. Eventually, aren't they going to be able to develop an individual self? Yes and no. And I'll explain how that works. So let's say you've got group souls, and each group soul is working mostly with one single type of energy within itself that it's becoming an expert on. And that type of energy is the dominant type of energy that it's going to use to to use itself to develop with. Doesn't mean it can't think, can't use all kinds of energy. But there are seven kinds of energy, represented by what are known as seven rays or focuses of beings that are very advanced, way beyond humans, that has an effect on the way the energies interrelate with the spirit part. And some souls are better at it than others, and usually there's one type of energy that we call one type of ray that a group soul is better at than the other six. And it's common to that kind of group soul that that happens that way. And they usually work with the most advanced animals. And eventually, at a time and place, determined by the whole planet's development, these group souls eventually break apart, so to speak. The energy parts of them recombine to become some of the best of all seven types of sense. So they get it all seven kinds of senses. And then they get all, we'll call it, all of the different varieties, and there's more than seven, actually, there's a lot of varieties, of spirits that come together to produce eventually a human soul. So you have the group souls eventually breaking apart, sacrificing some of their self-structure, okay? And that self-structure actually goes away in most circumstances. There's some exceptions to this, but in most circumstances, the self-structure goes away and is used later on as the self-structure of human beings, the spirit is. But the self itself is gone. So human beings really could remember their existence at a much earlier time as being part of a group soul wouldn't be possible. There are exceptions to this, and those exceptions I'll get to. But for the most part, it doesn't happen. Now, if you're a Buddhist, you may think I'm crazy. No, that did happen, because it happened to Buddha. So those were one of the exceptions. So just hold on. So here's how it works. So you got seven different souls coming from different species. And there's all kinds of combinations. You think about all the different kinds of advanced animals in the world. A lot of different combinations come together. And each one of them has somewhat differences in spirit. So you end up with a wide variety of souls that are human, and very complex souls at that. These souls now no longer have their self-structure in the third sub-world of the middle plane. Their self-structure is now located literally on the fourth sub-plane, of the second plane of the middle world. That's where the soul itself exists. And it's right in the center of the soul, is where the self-structure can be found. And it's kind of a unique design, because the human soul looks pretty much like the eye of a human being. I mean, it's pretty interesting. It's just the eye is the window to the soul, is also a picture of the soul in some respects. So it's a pretty close picture. And the self is right in the center, where we would consider the iris of an eye. That's where the self is usually found. A very, very tightly so inside the soul. And the self is able to think equally as well as the rest of the soul is able to sense with all kinds of energies that it is connected to in a thing called a lotus. So it's all connected in. A lotus is just a bunch of pieces of advanced solar energies that help the soul to think a little better. And amazingly, we have billions of combinations of souls. I mean, the number is probably in the trillions in actuality, because of this numerical value now. Let's do the math here. we've got seven different kinds of souls, but the seven different kinds of souls have a different emphasis of each one of the seven pieces by at least seven. So there's at least 49 types, and there's way more in reality. Because of all the different species and all the different emphases there are, in instinct, etc., no matter what the soul ray is, there's many, many different versions of that soul ray. So you have a vast number of senses that are adopted into a human being from at least seven different types of animals, advanced animals, coming together with even a vast greater amount of spirit in the soul that's connected and eventually creates a unique kind of self. Wow. So this is just fascinating. So you can have literally billions and billions and billions of souls, some 60 billion on a planet like Earth, supposedly, or more, that each is unique. Each is unique. There are no two souls that are individual souls that are the same. Group souls have differences too, but they're subtle. Human souls are not so subtle. They have a lot of creative differences, a lot of adaptive qualities that are different. Isn't that interesting? Okay, so each human eventually has a soul. And the soul then says, wow, I got all these neat senses and all this other stuff, but all of its senses are higher mental world senses. It doesn't have any sense of the lower mental world. It has no sense of the astral or the physical world. It doesn't know anything about it, except that it knows in a very abstract way that these worlds exist, because it gets that information from a being called a solar angel who lets it know about it. But, and that's an energy being. It's kind of like an alter ego to our soul. Sort of like a companion soul, but from a different part of the kingdoms. And it's more advanced, too, more advanced than the human soul. But it also only knows about the lower realms because it's been informed by part of itself that is connected to monads. And it gets direct contact with monads, so a thing called the triad part of itself. So some of it gets information that it doesn't even have to have experience from yet in its existence. In some cases, it has, though. A lot of these solar angels were companions to a whole bunch of group souls in much earlier times that were parts of all the lower forms of life. So they really did have some experiences, but not necessarily in the world that they're on, so they still have to get some information from monads because they're in a new world sometimes. But regardless, they have a wealth of information that they do share with the human soul, so the human soul knows what it's about to do. It's going to have to create a new being. Remember, a being has the senses and the thought, and just like I explained at the beginning of the show. A new being that is going to have to inhabit the worlds that it cannot go to without losing its senses and lowering its spirit, and its spirit will become darkened and won't work very well. And it doesn't mind, not going to do that, because he wants to stay connected to God. It'll send one at a time one of these beings as a pilgrim to go out into the lower realms and to try to create and adapt on its own and to create more of its creator, which is God, and create more of life, its own and other, help eventually to help other life, so that God can grow. That's part of what its mission is. But the soul doesn't do this on its own. It sends its surrogate into these lower realms to do the job. Yeah. Okay, we're going to go back to that after a couple-minute break here. Let your minds cool off, because after all, you know, I don't let the grass grow under my feet, right? Well, I keep yakking and yakking and yakking. All right, so I just wanted to let you know, if you're wondering what am I up to these days, one of the things I'm up to is I'm going to be writing some books, more books. I know, a lot of people say, I'm still trying to read what you already wrote, you know. Yeah, okay, but, you know, there's things that, there's whole niches that need to be helped out. One of them is I want to create several, probably a series of three based upon age. Three children's and adolescent, very young adult books that have more of a pictorial design to them, that especially the first, which is going to be for the youngest children, will be mostly a concept, but with a lot of illustrations and pictures. That will help young folks to understand God in themselves using principles of ageless wisdom. This is I teach here on the radio, but to the level that they can understand it, not as complex as the stuff I talk about, because it's beyond the conceptual understanding of children. So the concepts will be simpler, but still be true to ageless wisdom. And there'll be big concepts still, like where did God come from? Where did I come from? Where am I going? What's life all about? How come I have parents? What are parents in relationship to me and to the rest of the world? How come there are other people that have different things than I have? Those kinds of questions are important questions, and they'll be answered in this this book, which I'm excited about. And I hope to have it written in about 1 to 2 years, and maybe less. And not just written, but also get it published as well. And that will allow people to start getting messages about, we'll say, the universe and ageless wisdom in ways that maybe virtually anybody can understand, which is what I'm hoping for. So it's a children's book, but it's for folks who also have no maybe formal education, no anything, so there might be any adult might pick this up and say, hey, it's kind of an interesting book, even though it's for kids, you know, it's worth reading. So that's the kind of book, that's one of the books. And I'm looking for sponsors. Now, I've already found a sponsor to make that book. Now, what does a sponsor do? A sponsor is a person who puts up the funds so the book can get done. And what do they get out of it? Well, generally what they get out of it is the joy of giving and some connection with immortality, because the book will be done in their name. And it'll be done for their, in perpetuity, their having gifted not only the book itself, but also the royalties that they would get from the book, unless they want a different deal than this. Some people might not go with this, and this is okay. We have other ways of looking at it for some people who don't want to do this. But the royalties would then become part of a living trust to go forward and keep producing books under their name and their input. Isn't that interesting? I think it's a great idea. I don't know that if you all think of that. And if someone wants to just say, well, I want to do it, but I want the royalties to go to me, that's okay. You can talk. And the royalties would not be all the royalties. It would be some of them. But you can talk to us about that, too. I'm open to those kinds of ideas. I like the bigger, more giving picture myself, but whatever. But that's what a sponsor is. A sponsor is someone who comes up with some, not all, of the funds necessary to produce. Look, it isn't a huge amount of money. I work cheap. But, it's something to help make it happen. Part of the reason that some of these haven't been produced in the past is, to be quite frank, there wasn't enough money to go around to make it happen. It wasn't about me not being able to do it. It was about the resources. So this is a way to get resources generated for these kinds of projects. And if you like the idea, you know what? Just contact us. Who's us? Well, you can contact the group I'm a member of, or you can contact me directly, niles@whylifeis.com. Just send in a note to me, and I'll see that I'll be back in contact with you for sure, and others that are assisting me might do the same. So the important thing is that this is a way that you can contribute directly. So, you know, we don't ask you for anything normally. You don't hear me saying, well, send me money because it's tonight's show or whatever. I don't ask for that. But this is something that if you really want to be of some service in the world, this is a great way to do it, and it helps everybody. And it's a way to also become somewhat immortal, because each book will be dedicated to the person or persons who helped to create that book. And then if they go ahead and do the royalty thing, all the other books that are produced after that because of the income flow from that book will still have their name on it. So, I mean, they could have many books eventually with their name as being a sponsor for just by starting off. A good idea, huh? Okay, so if you're interested in that, let me know. Niles@wildlifeis.com, and I think it is, or Niles at, yeah, I think it's Niles@wildlifeis.com. It's one of those names. You try that one if it doesn't work. I'm sure there's other stuff up on the website that will tell you how to get a hold of me. I think that's what it is now. All right, so let's go back to the development of the self and talk about that idea. And so here we are. We've gotten to the point where we're talking about human beings now. And, you know, the thing about human beings is that compared to a group soul, this individual soul is so complex. It's such a better thinker. Itself is so much more developed. And itself is at such a higher place in the mental world that it can think for not only itself, but it can start thinking for other selves as well as part of the soul if it wants to. So that's a really cool part of the soul. The soul has spirit in it that can actually think for all other souls and it can join together. But that's the soul's self. It has to be, now this is the complicated thing. Stay with me on this. The soul says, gee, I love to go down there where all you humans are at and do everything you're doing. But if I do that, I'm going to lose myself. In other words, itself is itself of understanding of who it is. It actually has a self. But it can't give itself to us, and it can't come here and be us, because if it did, it would lose that self. That self could not survive in this part of the universe, because this part is too difficult on the spirit. The spirit in that self is very pristine. It's highly enlightened in comparison to the spirit that's in our self, which is I'm going to explain to you next. And it would be spoiled. It would literally be trampled. It would be destroyed. Well, the soul doesn't want to destroy itself. It wants to do the opposite. It wants to grow and become more of its creator. And it wants to create something that can do the same, but at a level that's lower, where it can survive. So it creates us, a human being, that has a self someplace else. Where is that self? It's in the lower mental plane. As a matter of fact, our self is in the very lowest place any self can exist. It's called the fourth sub-subplane of the fourth subplane. The very, very, very center of the entire mental world. And it's a very kind of unique place for, we'll call it, a self to be. It's teetering on not existing at all. At all times that it exists, it's teetering on not existing, because all it has to do is just slip one sub-subplane lower. And it'll be so inundated with spirit that is so dark, it'll just fall apart. It won't be a self anymore. And if it were to go a little bit higher, you might say, well, why not make it higher? If it were to be a little bit higher, it would interfere with something else that is highly needed, very much needed, by human beings. And that is a governing part of us that takes all the information from our senses, because we've got a lot of senses. We have three different bodies that are interconnected with seven senses each. That's a total of 21 senses. We have 21 senses that are giving information every second. And there has to be an integrating thing, an integrating something that's going to take all this information and convert it into coherent knowledge. That integrating thing is called the personality. Some people, there's other names for it. It used to be called the ego, believe it or not. But then that got confused with the soul. So nobody understood the difference between ego and a soul because they were used interchangeably and it confused everybody. So the personality, which is called the personality. Okay. The personality, and the personality exists from the first through the third sub-subplane of the fourth subplane. So it's right above and literally connected to our self in a thing called the mental unit. The mental unit is held together by the thought of the solar angel. And there's a spark of life, literally, inside the mental unit, in the heart center of the personality, called the second subplane of the fourth subplane, that kind of brings together this willfulness to be alive. And it's very important that spark be there, or else we wouldn't be able to keep ourselves together because we're too complex otherwise. And there's too many disparate parts of us. We're very, very not only complicated, but there's parts that are actually in conflict with each other. The personality is in control of the self. Now you might say, wait a second, you're saying the part that creates knowledge and that integrates sense is in charge of the self. Yeah, I am saying that. That's not much different than how group souls work, by the way. Group souls are above their self. They are. They're above their self. Only the human soul itself is in an equal position with its self, the human soul. But the human being is not. Personality, the informing part of us, informing part, is really the personality. And the self becomes secondary. Now you might say, well, why? Why not make the self supreme and we wouldn't have so much conflict? The problem is survival. If you are a behavioral psychologist, you're going to love this. In order for a human being to be able to survive, particularly through up to and through early adulthood, but certainly through early and mid-childhood, in order to survive, you not only need parents, you've got to have a part of us that is a little bit almost like a group soul. It needs to have almost a mechanical set of principles that it lives by. These are called thought forms that are very, very long-living, that we live by to keep us going based upon how we're programmed, in a sense, to live a certain kind of life. And these thought forms make it so that we adapt and we create within certain parameters based somewhat on karma after the very first lifetime that we have. And so there's a whole complex mechanism about this. I'm making it simple right now, but there's a whole complex mechanism of how the personality is formed. But the point is that the personality is there to keep us alive and to make sure we survive long enough so we can develop a self, and so that self can then go on to become both a creator and more adaptive than the personality. Personality is not very adaptive. It's again, it's fixed with all these different elements, and it deals mostly with energies. It's dealing with our senses, and it's forming knowledge from the senses, but the knowledge doesn't do much for us because knowledge is not a creative thing. You use it to create with, like bricks and mortar, but knowledge isn't the house. The house has to be created, or a building has to be created by someone like who has architectural understanding and knows what the design and structure has to be, etc. So it's really a different kind of thing. And we, unfortunately, have this conflict. The conflict is that at the beginning of our existence as infants, and until we're about 4 years old, by the way, we are almost totally governed by something that is really subconscious to the self, and in control in the beginning of life to the self. Now, after 4 years old, we slowly develop more and more self. And as we do, we develop more contact with our higher self, which is part of our solar angel. We develop a conscience, as an example, right around age 4. You might say, well, you mean like 3-year-olds don't have consciousness? That's right. Tests have shown they have very limited amount of conscience. The younger the toddler is, the less conscience it has. No kidding. Everybody thinks, oh, all human beings have a conscience. Not really. Little ones don't. They 4 years old, about where the conscience becomes a dominant part of the self structure. All right, so the self then is building. And the ideal is that the self and the personality get along. You know, the self is the conscious part of us. It's a part that understands who and what we are and why we're doing things. The personality is subconscious, both to the self and to us generally. And it doesn't understand much of anything. It is programmed. It's more like a computer program than it is a sentient being. It would be considered still sentient because in its own model, it is actually still making some creative choices and still doing some things as sentient because it's a very advanced being, even though it's the lowest part of a human being. And so it still has that, but it's more like an animal in part than it is a person. It's sort of like a mixture. And it's who we are. We have to live with this part of ourselves, the subconscious. Now, some of you say, well, isn't that the id? Well, sure, if you're Freud, then you can call it the id, if you can call it anything you want. I'm using the word personality because it's about as close an accurate description as of a word as you can get to in what it does and why it does it. Without going into too much detail about that, let's just accept that for right now. We'll have another show sometime just on the personality. Okay, so here's the conflict. The self is there to grow, and it becomes fully developed by about age 28. No, it's not 21, or 18, or whatever age you decide. Why is it 28? Well, because unlike most, we'll say, developmental models in psychology about human beings, which usually measure things like intelligence only, there's so much to the issue of consciousness. Consciousness doesn't become fully developed in most people until the age of 28. We may have our full intelligence by 21 or 18 or whatever, but intelligence is not enough to develop a self. You have to develop consciousness, and that takes about 28 years. That's why people between the ages of 21 and 28 usually have a rocky life. They make a lot of choices that ultimately, in a purely intelligent sense, may make some sense. But they don't involve great wisdom, and they oftentimes are lacking in consciousness, which is understanding and or givingness. So in relationships, they often fail. And in whether they're a parent or a spouse or whatever, that's a very dangerous time, 21 to 28, because people have enough ability to do many things at those ages in terms of their operation within the world, but the chances of their successes are probably less than even. So, good reason why probably not to get married so early, not to have children so early, or make extreme decisions about one's life that may affect them for their whole life. But we do all those things, right? I mean, we make our career choices, but the personality is pretty good about career choices, by the way. It's not so bad. It's terrible about relationships in terms of romantic love. It's terrible in terms of being a parent. It's got a lot of problems, but it's not too bad with vocation. So vocation, you'll probably be somewhat successful if you do it in the mid-20s and you're not 28 yet, you might be successful in your vocation. But not too likely to be successful in a marriage. Chances are probably against you, against all humans. All right, so now, again, on an individual level, there can be exceptions to anything I'm saying. I'm talking about generally, just so everybody understands where I'm coming from. All right, so personality wants to make sure that it's in control, that we're going to live and survive and have all of our needs and wants taken care of, that we will not be ill, that we will succeed in somehow escaping death for a very long time, if not forever. Of course, they can't do that, but it fools itself into believing that sometimes at a young age anyway. Yeah, young people don't even think about mortality, so they don't necessarily believe in their own, and of course, it's none of us there. Now, intellectually, they may understand it. I'm talking about they repress the sense of it in terms of any fears. But the personality does all that at great cost, because as the self grows, the person develops better character, they're able to give more to others, they're able to create more of their life, and eventually have more with greater and greater meaning by developing a more spiritually founded life, one that is closer to their creator. This, though, challenges the personality to give up its control, because it has to do that. And it also leads the personality into a quandary, because now it has to face the question of God. What has to replace the personality's fear of death, and fear of almost everything else, by the way, it's all connected to the fear of death, is the love of God, the love of all life, and the desire to become a part of God by being a co-creator and helping life to grow. This is the big change. The self is supposed to do this by gradually, not with too much fighting, but sometimes there's serious conflict, attempting to release the controls that the personality has over it and keep taking greater and greater steps towards taking more chances, we'll say. Every creation it does is a chance it's going to lose some security, lose something. To be creative, you're going to lose something. Because remember, the adaptability is what keeps you alive, but it's in conflict with the creation. So we're going to become somewhat less adaptable as we're becoming more creative. And then the adaptation has to catch up. And the personality doesn't like the fact that it is losing its ability to adapt to the threats in its environment every time we create something new that it doesn't know anything about and doesn't know what the outcomes are going to be and really what is that going to end us up with. The personality is like a bad parent. And that's why people who are too personality driven, at say 21 or 2, don't make very good parents. Because they're too personality driven and the personality itself is a bad parent, then the person becomes a bad parent. They are over-controlling, they lack the wise judgment to deal with children, and if they're not over-controlling, then they're laissez-faire. Well, just let the kids do anything, what the heck, and I'll go do my thing. There's no middle ground, there's no middle way, and that often leads to all kinds of disastrous, familiar problems. So back to our drama. The personality says, okay, I don't like this. Stop creating more of God. Stop trying to be godly, etc. And it really can fight for like 7 to 14 years. And it's a big fight. And if it gets into this fight, the fight isn't like everybody may think it in adolescence. That's a fight usually with our real parents. Although it's a foreshadowing of this bigger fight. The bigger fight happens between the ages of 28 and 42 for some people. That can be a very bad disaster. The reason is that these people haven't learned to let go of their controlling nature. And they have maybe been successful vocationally, which is sometimes a kiss of death, because it gives them a sense that by their success in vocation, a personality is good at that, by the way. They think that they know it all, they should be in control of everything, and they literally cease to be creative in ways that challenge their adaptability and challenge their personality. They become victims of themselves because the personality is continually over-controlling itself. Some of them develop personality disorders. Now, personality disorder could have its foundation in childhood, but it may manifest itself later in life and become much more treacherous to people. So, it's a very dangerous thing. Now, you can say, well, I heard personality disorder is really more adolescent. it is when it's reactive against the parent, and the parent is the surrogate for the personality. But it's much more serious, strangely, in later life than it is in early life. So it's something to consider. And more difficult to solve and to resolve. All right, so personality's got all kinds of issues about allowing its own self to dominate and become a new kind of being. Now, what is that new kind of being? Well, we can stay with our small self, and we can develop ourselves in all kinds of ways. We can become great at doing hundreds of different activities and in somewhat creative ways that are only for ourselves. If that's all we do, the self stays very small. It may become quite competent. It may even dominate at times our personality. But we never live our life as a soul. Now, what's the difference? The soul, if you remember, is for everything that it senses. It takes that sense of information. It creates it into knowledge that it then uses to serve others. That's what it's doing. It wants to give so that others can become more giving themselves. That's what the soul is doing. We, if we are trying to only become great as little selves, say, well, I'll be the best at playing the guitar. I'll be the best at singing. I'll be the best at running. I'll be the best at driving a vehicle. I'll be the best at doing this. So, yeah, but it doesn't, it's all about an I thing. And then we develop a self that has only limited character. Some people would even call it bad character. But it's not very good character. And we have a very minimal sense of God. And the meaning in our life every day becomes less and less, even though the self has grown. Because after the self is grown to the point where it can be giving to others and chooses not to, instead of life becoming more meaningful, it becomes less meaningful. Less. Because its creativity is dampened tremendously when the only thing it can give to is its own personality of itself. It's very limited in what it can give. And giving is what ends up giving it greater and greater consciousness. And as its consciousness shrinks, the meaning in life shrinks, and it suffers. And you could say, well, who came up with the system? Well, of course, God came up with the system. Our souls play within the system. They work within it. And they know about this stuff. They understand. Why would God make a system that puts human beings in such a tenuous and torturous place trying to deal with this very complicated and seemingly impossible predicament? Because we are the first part of life that can understand our Creator and choose to co-create with it. We're the first part of life that can do that. And that gift is so big. It's given to us, given by the nature of who we are. But we are given it initially, but then have to earn keeping it by using it. And let me say that again. From the second you're created as a human being, you're given the gift of being able to understand God and being able to co-create, understand how to co-create with God, more of God in life. You're given that. You don't have to go out and do anything for it. You don't get no merit badges. You got it. But if you want to keep it and not lose it incrementally and suffer for each loss, you've got to use it. And you've got to use it by practicing what the ability is. You don't do that, well, you're going to suffer. And you're going to lose meaning in life. And the reason for it is not to punish. It's a result of our own choices. So you couldn't really call it a punishment really means someone's doing something to you. Yeah. You're punishing yourself, if you want to look at it like that. And it's a guidance. It's like the only way that we can be truly free to create our own selves and our own life is that we have to be free to hurt ourselves. And if we choose the path consistently of hurting ourselves, it's our own doing. Now, I wish there was a better way. And so far, it doesn't appear that there is, because humans are saddled with this thing, not just in this world, but throughout the universe. It's a common issue with human beings. Now, does that mean that all of us are going to suffer immensely in each life? No. Because once you got this understanding, you can start to spiritually discipline yourself and move your life into the side where the suffering stops, the creation goes up, and instead of just creating your smaller self, you start creating this thing called the higher self, the bigger self, and you start becoming a living soul here, because the personality part of you starts becoming like your soul, and it actually fuses with your soul. And now you are just one being without these conflicts, who is seeking to co-create with others who are doing the same, who are all working to co-create with God. That's what it's about. And when you get to that level, welcome to heaven. Heaven can be right here, right now. It doesn't have, you don't have to wait to die and go someplace else. This can be the place where all of us are sharing in this remarkable journey that we are creating. We're not just on some train and struggling along and taking us where we're going. This is something we are the creators of. All because we have this free, independent self that can eventually break itself free from the over-controlling personality and can choose to live for more than just itself. As it lives more and more for everything else and tries to help everything else do the same, that's a critical part of it, is becoming a soul from that point forward in every thought and action that it takes. Tell me that isn't a good outcome. Now, the development itself is supposed to lead us into this. Now, I'm going to tell you that the average human loses at least 100 lifetimes by failing in this process. Average, at least 100 lifetimes. And for some, it's much larger. That's a lot of lifetimes. Think about the average lifetime. Let's say it's 70 years. I don't know. It could be more or less, but the point is, let's say it's 7 years. So that's 70 times 100 is 7,000. 7,000 years of lost development of self created by the conflicts internal to being human while trying to create from the soul's viewpoint God within the three lowest realms of our universe. It's a tremendous sacrifice, no question about it. And we truly are pilgrims on a great sacrificial journey. 7,000. That's just human physical years. What about the astral years and the mental years? Multiply that by at least another 30 or 40. Yeah, it's a huge number. 100,000. Hundreds of thousands of years that we fail. Now, you might say, oh, God. Let me out. Forget it. I want to go back to being a monad or whatever. Anything other than being a human being. A human being sounds like the worst possible place to be. You can't, it's like huge. And what about people who go 200 lifetimes to screw up? Isn't it? I mean, that's entirely possible. It's almost unbelievable, right? The good news is that from a soul standpoint, the soul doesn't really have to suffer through the lifetimes, just each individual lifetime is suffering. Can we change that? Yes. Every person has the ability, with understanding from what I've been teaching, and themselves practicing and checking it out and figuring it out for themselves to make sure it's true, every human being has the ability to change this. You don't have to be caught in this. You don't have to live your life so that this is going to be your outcome. If you're listening to tonight's show, I believe that you've got a pretty decent chance at stopping this whole nonsense. It's called getting off the wheel of karma, for those of you who are into that kind of stuff. But, you know, it's not really a wheel of karma. It's just I would call it a wheel of total ignorance and in understanding self. We just don't get what it's all about. And so we make over and over again the same bad choices. And it's pretty terrible. Now, I know some of you are probably saying, well, wait a second, you included if you're going out to 70,000, 100,000 years. Some of those years won't be so bad because you'll be in other dimensions where your consciousness will be higher and you won't do the same mistake. I agree with that. I threw that in here for a little drama. But even if it were only 7,000 years, or maybe 20,000 years, if you added some of the bad years that might take place in the lower parts of the astral world, you got it all together. It still is a lot. It's a lot of suffering. And it doesn't need to be that way. It's the reason that I do this show. It's the reason I write, teach, and everything in my life now. Because I'm trying to help others to save this for themselves. Truly, yeah. And, of course, it tremendously saddens me to see so many people in such a suffering position all the time. It's a really a terrible thing for me. It's a terrible thing to be on a planet where this is more prone to happen, by the way. But again, remember, we all came to this planet as souls on a volunteer basis. And we knew that this was going to be the planet that sucks, believe me. And that we were going to have lots of lifetimes where the development of self was going to fail and the personality was going to become disordered, or the self would become very limited and selfish, and we would have lost lifetimes. We knew this. But this kind of planet needs to be dealt with because it's one of the worst possibilities, and we need to deal with the worst sometimes, not just the best. If we don't deal with the worst, then this kind of thing can grow as a cancer in the universe and maybe someday take over most of the galaxy. That would be a terrible thing. You know, or even more than the whole galaxy if you count the part that's outside of it. You know, right now there's no entire galaxy as a galaxy that's gone dark, but if you count the darkness that's outside the galaxy, which has to be counted, then it's actually greater than the whole galaxy if in the total amount of darkness. That's an incredible amount of darkness. And the kind of darkness that's on Earth is so terrible, it's the worst of all the darkness kinds at this time in the universe, that if this sort of thing can't be dealt with on a very limited scale, like where we are right now on Earth, then just imagine how it could become something much worse elsewhere. Maybe in our own galaxy here, or maybe some other galaxy. It doesn't matter, because it's all part of God. That's the reason I am so concerned. And sometimes I really think, well, why am I even bothering? Yeah. Why am I doing this? But, you know, it makes sense that I am, to me anyway, because if I have the ability to help people to understand this, I should be doing it in every way I can. It doesn't mean they're going to listen to me. It doesn't mean they're going to even have any clue what I'm saying, listening or otherwise. But it's all right. I mean, I'll go along with that. I'll just continue to do the best I can, and that's hopefully going to make some difference. That's what each of us needs to be looking at. Okay, let's continue on with the development self. So humans can eventually develop a self that starts becoming a higher self. And what is that? The higher self is highly creative. I mean, it's so creative that it actually breaks the rule of the soul. You can go beyond this level of the human soul itself, where it is. You can actually become this great being, which is beyond the human soul, and start becoming more creative than you are adaptable. Remember, the human soul is this perfect balance, this wonderful copacetic and everything. But in that copacetic nature, it's not challenging itself even in its own realm as much as it could. But it can't challenge itself any more than that until it fully is adept in the lower parts where humans have to work. So between us and our soul, if we work together through a number of lifetimes, what we can do is we become the higher self. The higher self is way more creative than it is adaptive. So there's no more balance. Balance, be gone, yeah. It says, who cares whether I can adapt? It's not about whether I can adapt. It's whether everything else becomes more adaptable, even if mine isn't good. You say, well, wouldn't that, like, since adaptation is life, wouldn't that be suicide? Yes. Now, let me explain that. But it's true. It would be kind of a suicide of sorts. Now, let me explain how that isn't such a bad thing. The self I'm talking about is part of this thing called a solar angel. And the solar angel has already committed suicide, in a sense. It has given up this higher self part, called the monastic higher self, or mental higher self, to our soul already. It's already given it. It says, here, you can have it. It's all yours. And by giving it up, in effect, it cut that part of itself off, and it only exists in the mental world as much as the soul and we give it life, other than as no existence. So it's just amazing it has sacrificed that so that we can eventually become it. It's just fascinating. And what does it mean to become the super creative part that doesn't worry about adaptation anymore? It's because it's beyond the realm of needing to survive to live. It doesn't have to survive to live. What the heck does that mean? Okay, it sounds like something, you know, some great monk might have said someplace, but what does it mean? How do you survive without, you know, I mean, how do you live without having to survive? I mean, you know, well, surviving means that you keep intact the form part of existence in some balance with the spirit. And to a being that gets to the level where we're headed, to become what is known as a master or a superhuman, the superhuman no longer concerns itself with the form. It sees its form, at least in the three lower worlds to start with. Eventually it does this for all of its form. It sees its form as just an illusion and as a means of growing the third part of God's mind, which is really intelligent activity and not energy. You see, the solar angel is an energy being learning to not be an energy being. It is an energy being. It's composed more of energy than it is of spirit. And it's willing to give up the energy so it can become pure spirit. And that's what we're headed for if we fuse with it, and that's sort of what we're doing when we start becoming more of this higher self, where we learn to be more creative by a huge amount and not worry about the form part of us. Who cares about what this body or that body is doing when? So what? Makes no difference. It's just a bunch of energy that has to be brought into intelligent activity. Once it's brought into intelligent activity, you no longer worry about whether or not the form survived. Intelligent activity is beyond form, beyond energy. It's a third part of God's mind, coming back together, becoming one. So when we become one with God, we can't talk about ourselves having bodies. As a matter of fact, in order to become one with God and to leave this universe, you must give up all of your senses, all of your bodies. All of them. Not just the ones that initially we do to become part of our higher self. That's how you transcend our universe. Now, we're not going to get to that point maybe for a while. But I'm just letting you know that the end of this whole process is just a continuation of what I'm talking about right now. It's about not being concerned about the adaptation of form, but being more concerned about the co-creation of being God. And being God means that you're not hampered by being concerned about form or energy, but you're only concerned about creating more life that can do the same, that can create more life itself. That's all your concern is. And whatever hampers you in that, you're willing to sacrifice. Just like the solar angel, it's willing to sacrifice its mental body, the whole body, to our soul and us, so that it can become more part of God by helping to grow us as life. Wow. It goes even deeper than that, but I won't go that far tonight because there's a thing called the cosmic marriage, and it's really, really deep. I mean, this is getting into the super, super esoteric stuff if you really go take this further. It's amazing because it reveals so many big things, but it may not make a difference to someone who hasn't yet dealt with the lower issues. Maybe it would, but tonight I'm not going to spend the time on doing that because we'll miss some of the other more closer-in points that we need to cover. Okay, so here's the deal. Okay, we're faced with this dilemma to become super creative at all costs in order to benefit all of life around us. Our creation is not for ourselves. It's the creation of other life, helping it to grow in whatever place we can do it. And whatever it costs us in form is irrelevant. And so we don't even concern ourselves with that. We concern ourselves only with how much others are growing, by how much they are able to contribute to stillness. That's the full measure of what's happening. The higher self is who we really want to become. We want to take our lower self and change it into this higher self. Now, some of you may be a little bit confused, and I need to adjust for this since you understand this, that the higher self is still spirit. But the higher self works with things called solar devas. And it's a part of the total solar angel. There is more consciousness in total in the solar devas than there is in the higher self of the solar angel. It's a little hard to understand this because it's an energy being. It's not a human being. And so the solar angel says, here's my energy part. That's called the lotus. You keep that. The lotus is given to our soul, and then the soul gives part of it to the human being so we can think in conceptual thought. It holds concepts together that we ourselves don't have the thinking power to do ourselves. It isn't just a sense. It is a processing mechanism that holds concepts together. This comes from the solar angel. It gives that up to us. And then its higher self, the spirit part, takes those concepts and elevates them to the highest level that can be made. They can be made into, which is called the atomic level of the mental world. It's the first level, the highest level of concept that covers all of the lower concepts together. And that's the higher self part that we're getting. But the actual total amount of thought done by the higher self is not as great as the total amount of thought as done by all these solar devas. So, amazingly, because it actually does more thought with its energy part than it does with the spirit part, it's an energy being. But both parts are doing huge amounts of thinking, huge amounts, way beyond what human beings do. And they're doing so much thinking that they create a new kind of thought called controlled intuition. Controlled intuition. What is controlled intuition? It's the ability to join concepts together by hundreds at a time and create as many many thought forms as are necessary to exemplify those concepts in real time so that others can gain the value of those concepts in their understanding and grow in understanding. Others. It can't be done for yourself. You can't say, well, I'm going to sit around all day and become a genius. No, you've got to do it for others. And if you do it that way, then you're starting to use a thing called controlled intuition. really thought that is a whole plane higher. It's created in the Buddhic or intuitional world and applied to the mental. Really. Some would say that that's what I'm doing right now. Okay, so the important thing is that we are becoming this higher being, higher self, and we're also doing something to our energy part when we do that, because those solar devas are also, in a very complicated way, becoming part of us. There's bridges being built. There's all kinds of complicated things that there's a whole other show about that is also happening to us. But tonight's show was about the self, so that's what I'm sticking with. So once our self becomes our higher self, and it becomes joined, the self, the lower self, becomes joined with the higher self, we are no longer, in technical terms, human beings. While we are operating from the higher self, we are super human beings. Either we are arhats, which means we're in the last stage of being a human being, and a junior member of the superhuman kingdom. We're not a human being anymore. Arhat technically is a junior member of the superhuman kingdom. They have all the foibles and other problems of being human, but at the same time, they can serve, when they serve, as a superhuman. That's the difference. That doesn't mean they're beyond human yet. They haven't become a master of the ageless wisdom, but they're getting close. Probably within a lifetime or two, they will be there. And so that's the key. And that's what all that spiritual discipline you've heard in prior shows comes into play. That's what the whole thing does. And the development itself is really the key. It's really the basis for getting. Now, there were a lot of other things I skipped over tonight. A lot more that could be said about the development itself. But I think you get a pretty good idea of what it's about. Hopefully it has made some sense to you. If you want to know more, read those chapters, 4, 5, and 6, in Life's Hidden Meaning, and you'll become way more informed than anything I just talked about. And it'll give you a lot of details that I will get filled in that I didn't explain. Well, we are, as usual, out of time for right now. And